Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 134 of Registry Matters. Larry, 4th of July, you got big plans tonight for all the crashing, banging, booming, and all that stuff?
Well, there's no doubt there will be plenty of that in my neighborhood. There has been the entire week, and last night I had to turn on two fans to try to drown it out, and even that didn't work.
I don't even know. I don't know that I can even expand on this one, but I have heard that there are people that are doing this to paint the image in the protesters' minds that we are in a war zone or something like that. Did you hear anything like that, or am I completely nuts?
I have not heard that.
Okay. Maybe I just dreamed it. Dreamed. Is that a right word? Dreamed it?
I don't think so.
All right. Joining us tonight. Go ahead, Larry.
I think it's dreamt or something like that.
Okay. Dreamt. Joining us tonight is a super longtime patron, longtime supporter, and a very, very compassionate, nice individual named Mike, and he is from Florida. And wanted to come on and ask some questions to Larry, like directly, and just go over some things and maybe put some victories in Larry's, like the win column, just to confirm some things that Larry has said. Anyway, Mike, how are you tonight? Welcome.
I'm good, gentlemen. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you for coming. Thank you, kind of on short notice.
Hey, thanks for letting me be on here. I appreciate it.
Where do you want to begin? Do you want to begin with the Larry Was Right segment, or do you want to talk about Alabama?
That's pretty much my entire segment, the Larry Was Correct segment.
Okay, well, great. Thanks for coming. Talk to you later.
Yeah, I just wanted to say Larry is correct all the time.
All right. let me tell you a little backstory. Someone told me when I first got involved in all of this stuff, that was like, man, you really shouldn't listen to Larry so much. He's not quite as right as you think he might be. And I'm like, I don't have any frame of reference to even think that Larry is ever wrong. But I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing or talking about. So I was like, I mean, okay. But Larry will tell you when he is wrong, but I don't really have a whole lot of accounts of when he is wrong.
Yeah, so far he's batting 1,000 in my experiences of the things that I've, the information I've gotten from him.
Larry, what were you going to
say? I appreciate that, but boy, I blow it from time to time. And sometimes things come out of left field that you don't expect. But a lot of this stuff is just really, if you analyze why it's the way it is, it's really not as complicated as we make it out to be. And that's hopefully what we do on this podcast, is we simplify what people believe to be very complicated issues.
It is complicated, Larry. They use some crazy words sometimes, Larry, and they double speak and they backflip themselves and they twist themselves in knots. It is super complicated in my mind. Tell us about what you wanted to bring up out of Florida, though, Mike.
Yeah, what did I get right, Mike? I got to hear this.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I wanted to comment on. First of all, let me just say that I've been a fan of this podcast since the early days when it was pretty bad. It was a rough beginning.
How can you say it's bad?
Well, we're talking about sound quality, and I've followed you guys closely. I've never missed an episode ever. I've listened to every minute of every episode, so. Kind of a fanboy, and so I learned a lot from the podcast. So over the last year or so, I've took some steps to attempt to get myself off the registry in the state of Florida. Hired a very good attorney, one that has been successful in doing so. And as this happened, a lot of the things that I've heard, explained on this podcast, mostly from Larry, when he explains how things are going to work. A lot of this started unfolding, and I was watching it. I wasn't surprised by any of it. I'll start with the petition that we did a few months back when I went to court here in Central Florida. And so basically, I've been on the registry since the day it started in the state of Florida. I was convicted of a felony offense from I was 16 years old, but they convicted me as an adult. Fast forward, go to do my time in prison, get out, come home, done with everything. And then, all of a sudden here comes the registry. Yeah. that wasn't part of any deal that we made in the beginning, but everybody knows about how that works. So that's been, you know, at one point the registry removal process only had a 20-year time limit in the state of Florida. And at some point they changed that in the past few years. I don't know what year it was, but they changed it to 25 years. And then one of the requirements, and I'll bring up one of the stipulations in it, and it was really the one that kind of hung me when I went back on my petition, was you can't have any misdemeanor or any felony since you were released from your probation, any kind of supervision. I had a failure to register in 2002, and it was from my ignorance. Back then, I didn't have a computer. Don't remember if I'd been on the internet or not yet. And things used to come on a postcard when they updated the legislation. Sometimes you'd get it, sometimes you didn't. And so basically, I moved residences and didn't change my address within the 48-hour time frame. Didn't at the time, and it's my fault, I didn't know it was the law. I didn't realize it was a 48-hour window. So my home was burglarized while I was at work. I called the local police department. They came out, did their thing, realized that I hadn't changed my address, and a few days later came back and arrested me. And that was how I ended up on this failure to register. So fast forward now to 2019, which was when we filed the petition. The attorney that I used has had a lot of success in the state of Florida petitioning removal for people who have had a felony or misdemeanor since then. But what they've done is they've sort of post-dated the removal date, and they've gotten court orders. And I have seen many of them with my own eyes. I went over them because I didn't just hand my money over, you know, willy-nilly to anybody that said they could do this. And the attorney was very upfront with me and explained to me that there was about an 80% chance that this could go through, and there was a chance that it might not. So what I wanted to touch on, which is important for the listeners and people to understand, is that Larry constantly talks about how people interpret the law. And that's something I've heard him say many, many times, and I'm sure as everyone else has too. And he talks about the textualists and the judicial activists. And he makes that distinction many times. Well, when I went to court, they read, the judge that I dealt with read the statute exactly verbatim, word for word, the way it was written, and even read it back to my attorney. And my attorney argued with her and said, hey, there's plenty of other judges in the state that have already signed off on these and done these. And she said, yeah, but this is how it reads. This is my interpretation of it. And this is what, you know, how I'm going to decide. So I'm sitting there watching everything in real time. And I'm thinking about every time Larry's brought this up. And I'm like, this is exactly, you know, what I was prepared for. I knew that this could happen this way. She said, you have this, you know, this felony conviction. It's 18 years ago. And I cannot do this because this is what the law says. Now, in the judge's defense earlier, he had mentioned the temperature of the judge in the, you know, before the show conversation. The judge was very, very friendly, I guess I should say, very kind. She did tell me there that if this case was brought before her today, it would not be prosecuted. She said that I should have never been prosecuted. And she told my attorney this. And she said, I can't get you off of this today. She said, but here's how I want you to do it. Do it this way and come back to me and I can do this. So she did give him a legal avenue, you know, on how to do it properly. So the whole experience wasn't negative. But the reason I wanted to share it with people is if, you know, if you're considering this move, you're going to have to take into account that what he's been saying all this time is true. One judge may not interpret this the same as another. How that's possible, I don't know. But I've seen proof of it, and, you know, I witnessed it myself. So, you know, what Larry's been talking about for the past, you know, however long y'all been doing this podcast, probably a couple of years now, I guess. It's very accurate. You got to take the notion out of it that you're going to go to court and you're going to explain to them well, here's what you don't understand and here's what happened. That's not going to happen. They're going to look at the law, read it the way it is, in my experience, and that's what they're going to go by. You know, the only thing the judge did ask me my opinion on was why I was arrested for the failure to register. And I just explained to her, you know, I had no idea the law was what it was. I called the police to my house and they came back and arrested me, and they, oddly enough, they never caught the person that broke into my home, but you know, they came back and got me. They found me. So
they got somebody for something.
They didn't waste their money. You know, the taxpayers' dollars went hard at work. They got a dangerous burglary victim off the street. So
Mike, can I ask a question or two? We haven't done any pre-show discussion of this to speak of.
Sure.
What I would caution people when I say, please go talk to the prosecutor, I don't mean you personally, but a judge can do anything a judge wants to do if the prosecution is not going to appeal. The only thing that ties a judge's hands, well, actually, there's two things. I shouldn't say only one thing. There are two things that ties a judge's hand. One is if there's going to be an appeal. And if a prosecutor will agree not to object to something, then there's not going to be an appeal on behalf of the state of Florida. So therefore, a judge could overlook the waiting period if there's not going to be an appeal. So that's why I say go take the temperature of the prosecutor, find out if they will stand silent, find out if they're going to strenuously object. What is their posture going to be in this proceeding? Because you need to know that before you lay all your money on the table. And the other thing that would constrain a judge would be if the judge is elected, and particularly in the southern states, that tends to be more the norm than the exception. If we're coming up on a decision a judge is making in June and they're facing election in November, they're going to feel the constraints. So what you're going to want to do, if you have a case scheduled in election year, you would want to try to punt that thing past the election. So you tell your attorney, well, you know, I think I'm not as hurt to get off the register as much as I thought I was. And you'd want to get past the voter scrutiny, because if the judge, in fact, has an opponent, that would be fodder for the opposition to say he or she's letting these people off the registry and endangering the citizens of our county. So those are additional considerations that would come into play.
Yeah, I understand that. That makes a good point. And my attorney did actually reach out to them beforehand, and the prosecution was absolutely against it when we went in. Now, after the judge made the comments and the position known that she wanted to go with, she said, if you will go ahead and just withdraw your petition now, we will ask that the state lets you do it without prejudice, and you can come back and then come back and do it the way I told you to do it. And so that's what we did. And that, you know, that's where we're at now with it. So, you know, I'm not a legal mind, but I did. It was nice for me to go in, and I had a sense of what may happen. And I was very prepared. Believe it or not, I learned a lot from this podcast. So I wasn't totally blindsided when I went in. A lot of the things I heard, I'm like, okay, this makes sense. And the judge was very fair. You know, they did not treat me bad. They were very reasonable, which I know people probably want to say. I've heard so many stories about bad judges and things like that, but I didn't have that experience. The prosecutor was pretty hostile, but after the judge made the position known, and that seemed to calm down quite a bit, and then she agreed to do what the judge wanted to do when we came back. She said she would have no problem with that. So that's where we're at with that, and I just wanted to, you know, let people know. A lot of what you're saying on here is not just you're not just talking. This is how it's actually going to go down when you get there. And I did have, if you have any more questions about this particular petition, feel free to ask, because it's a quick process. It does not take long. Once you file it, you're in court pretty quick. And go ahead.
Sorry. I would say that what I would caution people to do is, if your state does have a removal process, be prepared to spend money. You're going to need a psychosexual evaluation. Even if the statute doesn't require it, it's good to have. And you don't want the judge to order the state assessment board to assess you because you might not like the outcome. So be prepared to spend some money. But your preliminary work is the most important. You need to find out how many of these cases the attorney has done successfully, particularly in the jurisdiction that you're forced to file in, because it's generally going to be where you were convicted, because it's a part of an ongoing criminal proceeding. If you move to a state that has a process and you're convicted in another state, you may get to file it where you're living. And that would give you the option to do a little bit of form shopping, as we call it. But take all this stuff seriously. If the attorney can't tell you they've successfully done these petitions, and they can't tell you what the temperature level is of that prosecution office, how they're going to react, if they have a standing policy that they rigorously oppose everything, if the attorney cannot give you these answers, you do not want that person to be your attorney. And you want to have that information, because if we had such a process in this state, that would be the first thing I would tell you. I'd say, well, you're forced to file in Socorro County. I just pulled that one out of the hat because we don't have such a process. But there's only two district judges in Socorro County, and neither one of them have granted a petition in the last 3 years. Now, knowing what I've just told you, and knowing that you're going to have to spend some money to have a psychosexual evaluation for us to have any chance, let me go talk to the prosecutor and find out if there's ever a situation where they don't vigorously oppose that. And if I come back to you and tell you they're going to vigorously oppose you, and neither of the two judges have ever granted a petition, you ought not want to give me your money. but the funny thing is, you'll leave my office and you'll go give the money to someone else. That tells you what I didn't tell you, but they tell you what you would prefer to hear.
No, that's accurate. I made sure that I didn't have a yes man before I went into this. I actually saw quite a bit of his history before we got this done. He showed me many, many cases that he had done recently, as recent as the week before. The only thing that he couldn't speak to, and it wasn't his fault, was really in the district where I ended up going back to court. He had never handled one there. But after the judge saw the charges and saw the case, and she spoke on it, she said that, you know, I told you what she said, that she would have never, I would have never been on it in today's, you know, criminal proceedings, whatever. She said that, I shouldn't be on it, and that she would have no problem taking me off of it if we did the way she laid out. And she laid that out for my attorney, and I understood it. I'm sure he did. And the prosecution said that at the time they were inclined to agree with that. So we'll see how it goes. And
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, that's what she said. You know, that's, we'll see. And it wasn't a horrible experience. And I have had, you know, I had that failure to register out of ignorance in the last 31 years. So it's not like, you know, I was out there ripping and roaring and, you know, committing crimes that they had to overlook a bunch of them. But unfortunately, that one felony is pretty much what hung me. If it wouldn't have been for that, it would have been a done deal. But biggest reason I called was just to let, you know, you guys know that, Larry, what you've been saying is accurate. When you get in there, and that's good advice. And if someone doesn't want to take this advice from you, they can take it from me. Before you go and put down your 10 grand or whatever it is you're going to spend, you better get some answers and you better figure it out, because you'll be just throwing money away. You'd be better off putting that money in NARSL or FAC, Florida Action Committee, before you throw it away on a lawyer that's just going to waste your money when you're not ever going to be eligible, you know, or you're going into a hostile environment that's not going to let anybody off under any circumstances.
Or maybe even putting it in Registry Matters Podcast.
Woohoo!
That's what I do.
But with that, you would also get your hopes up that something's going to be effective and you're going to waste some time that you could spend putting your energy into something that may be effective, or if you're just dead in the water to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's better to know. You know, it's good to know. But.
Well, I will say this about if I don't know what the offense, we've never talked about the details, but it's exceedingly difficult to try a juvenile in adult court here. So chances are they would never have gotten you in adult court here. And chances are this would never have been a miserable part of your life for the last 31 years, because we don't put juveniles on the registry, and we don't put juveniles in adult court except in extremely rare circumstances.
Yeah, well, welcome to Florida, brother.
Tell us what you're trying to do and finish your sentence, Mike.
Well, I'm just in the state of Florida. You know, if you can walk and talk and you can commit an offense or a perceived offense, yeah, they'll take you to court. They'll put you somewhere.
What do you have going on in Alabama that you're trying to get some insight into?
Yeah, I have a father that lives in Alabama, and he's been pretty ill for quite a while. So last week, I'm making plans to go see him. So I called the Alabama State Police and said, hey, you know, I'm registering in another state. I want to visit your state. I can't find anything online. I need some information about visiting there and what it says about visitors. And she couldn't answer the question. She said, well, what you need to do is you need to call the county where your father lives and ask them what they say. So, okay. Thought it was an odd answer, but she couldn't answer the question. So I called the county, and I think the population in that county somewhere around, or that little town, is probably 15,000 people. It's pretty small. So I get shuffled around a couple times, and I get this, what you'd imagine a good old boy sounds like. He kind of sounds like Larry's impersonation of them liberal do-gooders. Is how he came off on the phone, and I said, hey, I want to come visit. Father lives here, and what is the requirements? And he says, well, I need your name and your social security number and all that good stuff. And I said, nah, you don't need all that, just to tell me what the requirement is. I said, well, what's the requirement? And he said, well, it's probably best if you just come by here on your way in and give me your driver's license and tell me you're here. And then you can just swing back on by when you're on your way out, and you can let me know you're leaving. He says, I treat all my guys real good over here. And I told him, I said, I don't have any experience with it being good, just swinging on by, you know, and letting you know I'm coming in and out. I said, I'm smart enough to read this for myself, and I don't see anything I don't see any law that addresses this. They talk about moving there. They talk about moving there to work and go to school, but visiting, from what I understand, is if you're not there more than 30 days consecutively, you can visit. So anyway, the guy was just winging it. He was just like, hey, you know, this is what I do. And I said, no, sir, I'm not going to do that. I said, I'm from Florida, you know, and I'm smart enough to read these statutes and figure them out for myself, and you can't give me a straight answer. So, and he asked me for my name several times, and I said, no, we're not going to do that. So, and I just said, thank you and have a nice day, and got off the phone. But, yeah. You just can't, in my opinion, when you call these places, you just can't trust what these people will tell you. You're going to have to verify it for yourself. And if you don't have to, I am learning that I don't recommend telling them you're coming. If you're not by law supposed to do so, I'm not telling them, because I don't emit any of that radiation that Larry talks about that I know of. So as long as I'm not breaking any laws, I don't see any reason to swing by and see this good old boy and give him my personal information and, you know, deal with that nonsense. That was my experience with Alabama.
Did you tell me that he was a little bit more hostile to you and a little more condescending? It seems like how you framed it to me when we were talking about this.
He basically came off like a, just kind of like an old stereotypical racist redneck you would see on these shows. Like he was talking down to you, boy, that kind of thing. That's how he came off.
Right. Yeah, looky here, boy.
Exactly. That's what he. I'm being polite. That's what he sounded like. And I told him, I said, yeah, I don't think so. So he was trying to play some games. But I just wanted to.
What is the statute in Alabama then for you visiting?
As far as I can tell, from everything that I've read, I checked Wiki Narsil and I checked their website. As long as you're not there for more than, I think it's 30 days, you can visit. As long as you're not working or going to school or show intent to, you know, have an address. So in other words, if you go there and you get a job, you better register. Or if you go there and you start going to school, you better register. But if you're just visiting, I think you have a set amount of days, and I'm pretty sure it was 30 days or no more than 30 days in a year. But that's, you know, from what I understood, that's what it was.
What do you think,
Mike? Mike, I pulled the statute for Alabama, the complete total, and it has 75 pages. I don't believe I've ever seen one that was 75 pages before. And I did a I did a quick scan of it before we started recording, and I'm not so sure that I agree with you on that, but what I will say is that I don't think they would be able to answer the question, because I'm trained in this business, and I don't see anything that addresses visitors at all. But I always promised people that although they do have to cite to a section of law if they're going to do a successful prosecution, they have to put on a piece of paper in a charging instrument what section of code that you violated, because if they didn't do that, you wouldn't be able to mount a defense. You wouldn't know what the elements are, what so they have to tell you when you did it and what section of law you violated. And I can't see a section of law that they could cite to that would be sufficiently clear that would generate a conviction if the courts were working anything at all in the way of trying to administer justice. I just can't see it here if you're merely visiting. But I can see, on the other hand, how people would read this and they could conclude that it says what they would like it to say, which is everybody seems to want to have an obligation to register when they're in the interstate visiting. They believe somehow or another they should have to register because in their state, perhaps they have such a requirement that if you're physically present. But there's a lot of states that where the state does not have a provision that addresses temporary physical presence. But if you are registered in Alabama, it's clear that they've defined what living means if you actually are covered. What reside means, that this tops Maryland, I think, and the Maryland listeners should get a kick out of this, to be habitually or systematically present at a place. Whether a person is residing at a place shall be determined by the totality of the circumstances, which lends itself to a lot of subjectivity, including the amount of time the person spends at the place and the nature of the person's conduct at the place. The term reside includes, but is not limited to, spending more than 4 hours a day at the place on 3 or more consecutive days, spending more than 4 hours a day at the place on 10 or more aggregate days during a calendar month, or spending any amount of time at the place occupied with statements or actions that indicate an intent to live at the place or to remain at the place for a period specified in this sentence. A person does not have to conduct an overnight visit to reside at a place. Now, I love that. Like I said, I'm in this business and I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, that's insane.
And what is the place? Wow. You're going to sort of kind of stay at the place, but maybe not, but sort of think about something. Like, wow, that's... Who writes these things, Larry? That's one of your people that writes these things.
No. This would have come from law enforcement. This is something that they would have dreamed of. And since Alabama doesn't have any advocates or didn't have the time that they were admitting the registry, the most draconian changes occurred during the Riley administration, which was a number of years ago. Alabama at one time didn't have too bad of a registry, but they changed it in the early 2000s, somewhere in the early before we hit 2010. And I believe it was under Governor Bob Riley, but I don't blame him for it, because he only gets to sign what passes. If you can't get it to the governor can't sign it. Somehow our people lose track of that. Governors can only sign, and presidents can only sign what makes it to their desk. But this I think would top Maryland. Maryland has this 4 days, 4 hours, 7 days, or 4 days. Brenda might know with more clarity what it says, but I think this tops what Maryland has.
She did say in chat that it's worser.
Worser.
So let the transcriptionists get that one.
I do not believe that there's specific coverage for visitors, but that is not to say that they won't tell you that there is, because now you got to remember, you're calling an elected official. These are local elected officials, sheriffs, and even police. There's a political angle, because they have to go through some process to become police chief, and it's usually by a mayoral or a council appointment. But you're calling people, and you say, I'm a sexual offender. I would like to visit your territory. They're not likely to say, well, you just come on, stay here as long as you want and have a good time, and we'll pretend like we don't know you're here. I mean, they're not likely to say that, so they feel like they have to tell you something. And beyond that, if they tell you, if you call and say, well, I want to know what the rules are, how would you respond if they said, well, you know, we've had our legal team look at this, and actually, we don't think there really is anything that addresses a temporary visit. So in our opinion, although I'm not a lawyer, that I'm not sure you have to do anything. Would you hang up the phone and be satisfied with that? Or do you think they're trying to lure you in so that they can put the handcuffs on you? Would you be trusting of that advice where they said, I don't think there really is a requirement? At least our legal people tell us that there's not such a requirement. What would you say then?
I wouldn't trust it at all. That's why I didn't give them my name.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So I think they're in a no-win situation. If they say, come on, we want all the sex offenders to visit we can, that's a loser. And if they say, well, we don't think there is a requirement, that's a loser because nobody wants to hear that. And particularly the citizens of that county, they'd be appalled if they knew there was no coverage for a person visiting. So I think I don't ever advise anyone to break the law. But if the law is not crystal clear that you have to register after being physically present, I don't know why you want to place an obligation on yourself that isn't in the statute. That boggles my mind that you want to go do something that's not clearly defined. I only want to do what I know I have to do. If it says I have to renew my driver's license every 8 years, why would I go in every year?
Isn't there some sort of like a blanket thing about the hovercraft? If you know that the hovercraft is going to be following you, then you should do extra things because you know the hovercraft is coming about?
Well, you know, we talked about last week their hovercraft might actually be out there. But even if the hovercraft is there, if there's not a particular section of law that you're in violation of, I would hate to be, if I were working on the prosecution side, I would hate to try to draft a complaint utilizing the language that I just read.
About the place.
I would hate to have to put forth a complaint to try to secure a conviction based on that. I'm not saying they don't do it. I'm sure they do it all the time. But I would find that so confusing that as a drafter, I wouldn't be able to draft up the complaint.
Very interesting. Mike, is there anything else that you wanted to hit before we send you on your way?
Sure. I did have one more quick comment or question for Larry. Larry, last week I called FDLE. I had a question about I own a small business that I work on the side of my, you know, it's what I call plan B for my full-time job. If it ever, you know, fails, I've got something to hit the ground running with. And there were some questions about the legality of it. And so, and my registration requirements. So I called FDLE, said, hey, here's my question. So the first person I talked to said, well, here's how I interpret it, but I'm not 100% sure. Let me ask a supervisor. Can I call you back? I said, sure. So a few minutes later, supervisor calls me back, asked me the question. I explained it to her. She goes, well, here's how I interpret it. She said, but what you want to do is call the local sheriff's office where you live and ask them how they interpret it because they'll be the ones arresting you. And I said, let me get this straight. You're FDLE and you're in the registration department and you're taking these calls, but you don't understand this. And I need to ask a sheriff behind a desk or, you know, it's whoever works in the registration department, how they interpret it, because they'll be the ones arresting me. I said, it's a little sketchy, but so I called and I got someone there and they gave me their interpretation of it. And I asked to speak to a supervisor. They accommodated that. And I got, explained it to me, and he interpreted it the same way. The upside to it was all four of them interpreted it the exact same way, which was fine. I was just trying to fact check something to make sure I was, you know, in compliance. And but I just want to know what you thought of the FDLE registration people telling me to call the local sheriff's department because they would be the ones arresting me and how they interpret it. I mean, does that sound right to you?
It does. And for those who are not in Florida, that's the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. But it does. When that's one of the pitfalls of having local administration of the registry versus state administration, because sheriffs are elected in their own right, and FDLE can really not tell them what to do. In terms of you could not order a sheriff not to prosecute someone if they felt they were in violation of the registry. Now, ultimately, it would be if you contested that violation and you took it to trial, it would ultimately be up to a judge or a jury. If you decided to go to a jury on the question, it would be up to a judge or jury, or unless it was something where you could procedurally can it with a motion. Sometimes you can concede every point of the complaint and say, but even if I did everything they alleged, it doesn't constitute a law. You can get a dismissal without having to go to trial. But I would say that does sound consistent with what you would hear in a state where the sheriffs manage the registry. The FDLE just maintains the internet and they make recommendations. But ultimately the sheriff is their own little fiefdom.
Well, Mike, there you go.
Well, I mean, it is what it is. Fortunately for me, where I'm at in the counties, I'm down in Central Florida, the registration people that work there, whether it comes down from the top or not, I mean, I've gone through, well, I don't know how many sheriffs have been elected since I've been registering. The people that have been there have been, they've been very cordial, very friendly. I haven't, you know, they've been treating us, they've treated me very friendly, very kindly. And I'd like to say, you know, that they're evil and they're mean and they're terrible, but that just hasn't been the case. They've been some decent people. And I wanted to make sure I was in compliance. And I knew quite a few of them by first name now, because I've been going there so many years. And, but anyway, that's really all I had. I just wanted to kind of bring to light some of the stuff that, you know, Larry has talked about and you guys have brought on here. It's very accurate and it's good information. If you mine it for what it's worth and, you know, take it, and especially if you're going to mount a legal challenge, listen to what Larry's been saying about finding out about the judge, about the prosecution. I did all that research before I went in. I found out who put the judge in office, what governor was there, who, you know, what their political party was. I did as much research as I could to try to, you know, educate myself, and my lawyer did as well. So, but I really appreciate y'all letting me come on here and bore people to sleep. But I love the podcast, and I really appreciate what y'all do. I'll listen to it till the last one.
So, let me have your address, please, and I'll mail you a check.
Right? That's what I'm saying.
Well, just make it out to Registry Matters Cast. That's fine. I'll gladly give it to those guys.
Well, those very kind words. I really appreciate that. And hopefully that people that listen to the podcast will benefit from that wisdom of we really are trying to guide you in the right direction. We hate to see you spend your money needlessly unless you just have money to burn. And most people don't that are in this situation.
Mike, I appreciate it. You've been a super long-time patron and a very generous one, and we text frequently throughout the week, and I enjoy them, and I also enjoy pictures of your dogs very much. They're very sweet, and I appreciate
you
that you have a pound puppies, basically. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's how we roll.
Have a great fourth, man. Enjoy your family.
Thank you. All right, good night.
All right, bye.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Larry, are you ready to knock out these cases?
Let's do it. I'm ready for some explosions.
Some explosions. All right. All right. The first one is, I'm happy that you send me articles so I don't have to read all the legalese. So the first one is coming out of TechDirt, and it says, Indiana Supreme Court says compelled decryption of smartphones violates the Fifth Amendment. I somehow have a feeling, Larry, that you put this in here on my behalf.
I did indeed.
And this is a woman who had a phone, and they said, unlock it, and she said, no. And then, so a judge has said that she doesn't have to do it, and I'm definitely going to highlight some of the things that I think are important about it, but please give me your side of it before we dive in.
Well, now, you know, we have that segment of general rules.
Yes.
And I think that this one would belong in that segment of Larry's general rules.
This is the general rules of criminality?
Yes. Yeah. The lady in this, she had called the police on her boyfriend. The only problem is that she was the one committing the crime, and her phone revealed that she'd been making a lot of harassing phone calls to him. So as a general rule, I would encourage anyone who is stalking or harassing and doing naughty things with their telephone, you ought not call the police and get in a position where you turn your phone over to the police. I would strongly encourage you not to do that.
All right. I think that sounds fair. You don't call the popo when you're doing things that are bad.
Well, especially if you're going to have to, if you might be asked for your phone.
Yeah, well.
So, Caitlin Seal.
Do you think at this stage of the game that they're going to ask for your phone just sort of as general practice?
Well, let's just read the facts and procedural history. It's not that long. Caitlin Seal contacted her local sheriff's department claiming DS had raped her. Detective Bill Inglis met with Seal and she told him her smartphone i7 Plus contained relevant communications with the accused. With Seal's consent, officers completed a forensic download and returned it. And so she initiated the contact with the police. And then Detective Inglis learned that Seal's first contact with DS from a prior phone number. And then he learned that DS had been receiving up to 30 calls or text messages daily from different unassigned numbers. So she was spoofing. So like I say, if you're going to accuse someone of a crime, particularly of a sex crime, you probably ought not have been doing anything naughty on your telephone. I would just say that as a word of advice, but
I think that's fair to start. I think though that you've stated though that you think that it, and I don't disagree with you necessarily, but if you have a safe in your house that has all the bad stuff that you've been doing, and they're going to either ask you for the combination and they're going to get into it, or they're going to break it open, which will take them longer depending on the safe, but they're going to get in, they're going to get your naughty stuff.
Well, this is more confusing, and I've read the opinion, and I think that we need to talk about it briefly, maybe come back to it on a future episode, but what it seems to come down to is whether or not the law enforcement was wanting to go on a fishing expedition, and they didn't really know what they were fishing for. And if you've ever seen an affidavit for a search warrant, you shouldn't have a search warrant granted that's vague and devoid of specifics. You are looking for a specific item or items. And you state the reasons why you believe those items will be found within the contours of the area that you're asking to have searched. This officer did not know what he was going to find. He just wanted to go fishing through the phone because the DS was saying that he was getting all these calls and text messages. They could have been coming from her, but maybe they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So what it seems to turn on is there was not sufficient precision in the request by the officer. He wanted to go fishing. But if you're inevitably going to discover what you know is there, it seems like the way I interpret this is the court is more lenient if you know what you're looking for, but you can't go fishing. And that's what he was doing. He was wanting to go on a fishing expedition.
What about the part of this? This is the part that I'm interested in. That I get that your phone can be used in the commission of crimes, and you could be committing multiple different kinds of crimes. And so they're looking for crime kind of A, and while they're looking at your phone, they find crime kind B. They didn't get a search warrant for crime B. Where does that fit in the equation?
Well, that's what's confusing the court as well. They don't know. But it's the same thing that happens when you're doing a regular search of a physical dwelling. When you're looking for with specific items and you uncover other items, you go back to court and ask for a warrant based on the probable cause that you believe you'll find it, because the probable cause is pretty good because you've already found it.
Yep. some other points that were brought up, though, which I should have thought of, but I frankly hadn't. Many people have, when they go to a website, it automatically logs on for them. So now that you've unlocked the phone and now you have perhaps automatically logged into their bank or Facebook or all these other places that they didn't get a search warrant for. And I know that organizations use Dropbox heavily. So now you've just granted them access to all of that data too. I know that's
in the decision. Did you read that in the decision? That's in here.
I didn't read the decision, Larry. That's way too much. I read the actual article, though.
On page 9, if you pull it up on the highlights, page 9, for example, if officers searching a suspect's smartphone encounter an application or website protected by another password, will they need a separate motion to compel the suspect to unlock that application or website? And would the foregone conclusion exception apply to that act of production as well? Suppose law enforcement opens an application website and the password populates automatically, which is what you just said. Can officers legally read that information? Or what if a suspect has a cloud storage device like iCloud or Dropbox installed on the device, which could contain hundreds of thousands of files? Can law enforcement look at these documents, even though this windfall would be equivalent to identifying the location of a locked storage facility that officers did not know existed, which is what would happen in your house? What would happen if they searched the safe and you had a key to a safe deposit box? And what they would do is they would go back to a judge and they would ask for a warrant and they would articulate what they think they would find in the safe deposit box. If they just said, we want to see it, that wouldn't be good enough. But they would say, based on what we found and based on the notes, based on blah, 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 we believe in the safe deposit box, we will find this.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an extremely exciting area of developing law because we just don't know the answers to these questions.
Can you go over the term that they use throughout this thing, foregone conclusion? I mean, I know what the term means that you sort of already know, but how does this apply in a legal sense?
Well, there are exceptions given for when law enforcement breaks the rules. I mean, the courts have granted. If it's something that they would have discovered anyway through normal channels, investigative techniques, it's a foregone conclusion. So therefore, you don't get suppression on what they would have discovered. But some of the stuff they may have never discovered if they force her to unlock her phone. And that's what the court pointed out, that there was no foregone conclusion here, that they didn't know anything. They didn't have the information. There would have been no foregone conclusion. They didn't know what was in the phone. That's why they wanted to go surfing.
And to get the search warrant, you have to present to the judge that you believe that you will find these things. So you have to tell them that we are looking for X, Y, and Z. We believe that we will find them there. Then they get the search warrant, then they go execute. They do or don't find and move from there. They don't just go, kind of like to take a look around and see what we do find.
Well, in the course of searching, they will see stuff that's in plain view. And there's the plain view rule. Like I say, they will, if they came looking for financial documents, because you were an embezzler, and your house was just filled with drug paraphernalia that was illegal in plain view, they would go back and ask for the judge. I mean, they would secure the, so you couldn't destroy it. They would not let you destroy the evidence. So they would go back and tell the court that they believed they would find drug paraphernalia and illegal drugs based on what they observed in plain view. And they would get a warrant. In some cases, they wouldn't even bother to get a warrant. They would say with the plain view exception controls, it was in plain view. But if they went rummaging through drawers and they went looking for it and it fell out of a drawer, the safest thing to do, which I'm always believe doing things the safest way, the safest thing for the cop to do is to secure the location and go get a warrant. That's the safest thing to do.
Fair enough. Should we move on? Are we ready for that?
Well, I think this is just totally exciting. I wouldn't have expected this out of Indiana, but the Indiana Supreme, no, this is not the Supreme Court. What is this? Before I misspeak. This, yes, it is Supreme Court of Indiana, the Supreme Court of Indiana. So this is the law of the state, the Hoosier state. This is, they will not be able, they will not be able to force you to unlock your phone.
Tell me which district that is and who also that would impact.
Well, this is a state decision, so it only affects the state of Indiana. But it's powerful, persuasive argument for other states. Like if I had this issue arise, I would go cut and paste as much as I could from this analysis into any argument here, because I'd say this is just very fine analysis here.
Will they appeal?
There's really nowhere to appeal to.
They couldn't move it to one of the districts?
Well, this is a state question here.
Okay. So this is the end of that question.
If they could invoke some constitutional, if they could invoke some U.S. constitutional, but this is the end of the road here. And this court cited U.S. Supreme Court, two cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court that helped them come to their decision. So I don't see this going any further. This is, if you're in Hoosier land, you're protected. They're not going to be able to force you to open your phone with a password, and they're going to have to articulate with precision what it is they're going to find and what they're looking for. But just telling you to unlock your phone, not going to happen. So if you're doing naughty things, you might want to go to Indiana.
Oh, very well, perfect. Let's move over to law.com. Reimagine the role of police. A gradual process of strategically reallocating resources, funding, and responsibility away from police towards community-based models of safety, support, and prevention will go a long way toward bettering our society. We don't have to spend a lot of time here, Larry, but reading through this article, I personally don't find flaws in the idea of if you have this kind of issue, direct that kind of resource towards it, and if you have that kind of issue, this one over there, then you direct that kind. You don't always have to have police with their badges and their guns and their tasers and the radio blaring and the lights. And like, you don't always have to send those people to solve all problems. And this it's not even much of a framework of anything, but just starts talking about the concept of different organizations that could possibly handle situations differently. And I liked it.
I like it too, but I would just say a couple of words of caution. When we talk about this in the abstract, then there's the reality of the practice. Now, when you're dealing with people who have all these various issues, they can be very volatile. And I don't wish this to be an outcome, but it's just inevitable. There will be an outcome where a person was being dealt with by a mental health professional that will escalate, despite the fact there are no police there, and then someone will get hurt. And then we're going to be saying, well, why weren't the cops there? So just be aware that when we have the beauty of looking back through the rearview mirror, let's don't be critical of the police if we don't want the police there and something happens.
We always want them there with their guns and escalating and all that, which we will have an article coming up here that will make that rather apparent. And I'm just being, tongue in cheek on that.
So, well, we don't want them there escalating, but we also, if something happens when a situation escalates, despite every effort of the professionals to calm it, and 14 people get taken out, then we need to cut the police just a little bit of slack if we've invited them out.
Correct. Yeah, I know. Somebody forwarded me like a book from Facebook that in the larger comment of things of was, hey, if you don't like the police, that's fine, but they make me feel safe. And I was like, well, the key word there is make me feel safe, where it's like, I don't know. Having them run around the way that they are, I don't think everyone feels safer. I don't think they are necessarily safer. It's just an interesting way to phrase it.
Well, I agree. But when I said take 14 people out, I don't mean that literally, but yeah, if you're dealing with someone who has a mental health issue, perhaps without the police presence, there wouldn't have been a full body search of the individual. And then if the person escalates and they pull out a blade and they whack two people, and there's no police presence? Are we going to be patient and understanding that this happened because we were trying to handle it in a non-confrontational way and we didn't have the police there? I hope that we don't have that happen, but when we do, we need to realize that it happened because the police weren't there, because we invited the police out.
If you remember back to, I want to say it was this episode, we had the individual, Nick Durbin, I believe is the name, and we were talking about a person on the registry with autism, and the person's sort of like just hanging out outside, and they have a person guarding them, and I mean as a guardian, and things kind of go south, and the police show up, and a bullet ricochets off the ground and kills the person. I may have those details slightly sketchy, but the police show up and escalate things, so it could end up just being sort of like a wash of, well, these people didn't die, but these people did die. Not that that's good, just like it could just end up to be move numbers from one column to another one.
Or it may be we have to adopt a hybrid approach where that scenes are secured like we do in fire and rescue. There's places where fire and rescue won't go until the police pronounce it secure. And sure, it may be that we have to make sure that there are not weapons in play, and then we'll bring the professionals in to handle. And I'm not by any means professing to be an expert in innovation for the police. I'm merely acknowledging that what we're doing now isn't working to its optimum for society, but I don't have all the answers. I know that we're killing too many people, and I know that police escalate too many situations. I know that suicide people do not need guns drawn on them. That's not very helpful towards talking them down from the ledge, but I don't know what all the answers are.
Absolutely. And from Courthouse News, 11th Circuit blocks order allowing felon voting in Florida. This is confusing, complicated. It keeps going back and forth. The citizens voted to repeal the Fourth Amendment that allowed felons to vote. Then the Republican legislature put in blah, 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 blocking felons from voting because of fines, fees, and other things. Then some judge, I think, said it was okay, and now another judge says no.
Kind of.
I think that's the order?
Kind of. Yeah. The citizens passed the amendment four, and then the legislature decided that the citizens and what they meant, although it wasn't specified, that all obligations meant fees and costs. So the legislature passed Senate Bill 7066, which required that they, before they could be restored, they had to pay all those monies, which in many cases had escalated exponentially because of the years that had passed. So the Republican-dominated state of Florida decided that despite the fact that's overwhelmingly passed, we want you to have paid everything because the wording of I have to agree with them that the wording did say all, and I guess it depends on what the meaning of all is.
What is the definition of all, or is, or... we can ask Bill Clinton about some definitions.
So then the matter was taken to court in federal court, and U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle, a liberal appointee, ruled that it was unconstitutional, that legislation that the state of Florida passed and governor signed was unconstitutional. There was an appeal to the 11th Circuit, which the 11th Circuit is Florida, Georgia, and Alabama, a small circuit of only three states. And the three-judge panel said the trial judge got it right. And then what we hear, you hear us talk about en banc review, which is the review of the full court, which is seldom granted. DeSantis and the Republicans in Florida weren't happy with the three-judge panel, and I think I predicted that they would probably continue to fight this. I don't remember what I said verbatim, but I think I predicted that. They asked for en banc review, and it has been granted. So that means that this is going to be decided by the full 11th Circuit, not just the three-judge panel. And in the meantime, the order was stayed, meaning that the felons were not going to be allowed to vote until this is decided. And this probably will not be decided until after the election because the 11th Circuit is notoriously slow on controversial stuff.
Well, that sucks. And you are fairly convinced that it would probably just be a split, 50-ish or so percent would vote one way versus the other way. So in the end, it probably doesn't necessarily make much difference in the end of having these people vote.
No, I don't believe that. I believe that the Republicans would benefit handsomely if they allowed.
You think absolutely.
Oh, no, I think the Republicans would win this hands down. I think they're too dumb to realize that. But I believe I believe that if you listen when you're in prison, listen to the politicking that you heard. Conservatism runs rampant behind the prison walls. I believe that outside the minority communities, that the Republicans would get an astronomical amount of former convict votes. So I think that they're shooting themselves in the foot. I really do. I don't think it'd be a 50-50 split. I think that the minority vote would largely go to the Democrat Party, but I think the Republicans would win. Would have the net benefit of having these people vote.
The prison population, at least in the South, is not quite 50-50, but close.
Well, and I'm granting you that within a minority community that the Democrat Party would, but we're not talking about just the minority. I think Florida has their entire census of prisoners online. Find out what the racial makeup is.
We'll do that for a later time. Unless somebody wants to do in chat. I'm just doing internet research while we're recording.
I think the Republicans are being short-sighted, but they believe that they're doing the right thing. They believe, I mean, I think that they're being short-sighted. Dumb was too strong of a word, but I think they're being short-sighted. But they believe that the law, the amendment was clear that all obligations includes that, and they're fighting for what they believe in. Okay, fight for what you believe in. That, I mean, there's nothing really wrong with that. they're fighting for
there
position.
It says Florida does not have a statewide database for those who owe restitution and fines, and the state's Byzantine patchwork of record keeping prevented many felons from learning about outstanding financial obligations before registering to vote. Well, if there's no sort of easy-ish way to figure out what you owe, how do you figure out what you owe?
Well, that was part of what the district judge pointed out, was that this was an impossible thing. But then you've got to go back and figure out what to do about it because, I mean, all depends on what the meaning of the word all is.
I gotcha. We have a handful of articles relating to Corona and don't really want to spend a lot of time on it because I'm sure we all have Corona fatigue. But it's not possible for us to just let it go. And the first one that we have is from The Intercept. And the title is Prison Officials in Kansas Ignored the Pandemic, Then People Started Dying. There's a video that goes along with it. It's about 10-ish minutes long. And I think it's a stellar thing to look at. Because what ultimately happened is a prison guard quit and he's leaking all the tragedies that are going on and the inadequacies of the handling of it. And I totally, Larry put it in there and I didn't want to let it slide by because I just thought it was an incredibly well done 10-minute video that I think people need to see.
Did you listen to all 10 minutes of it? Because I didn't finish it.
I did.
Did you listen to it? So you can tell me what I missed.
Well, I don't know where you stopped. The guard was, they're just almost like saying, hey, nothing to see here. Keep moving. And at first, do you not have Corona in your town because nobody has it or because no one's being tested? And it looks like that's how things went. Then eventually, like a couple people test positive, then more people test positive. They even show as the clip goes along of how many people at different time intervals. It goes from like one, and then there's two, and then there's five, and then there's 10. And then next thing you know, over like the span of 30 days, 900 people have it. So is that just from testing that they had a clearer picture of it? But still, people are in bad shape, man. And being stuck in these places, it's just horrible. Did you see the segment in there about the person that had, I think, like 80 days left?
Yep, sure did.
So, we to reference back to your riot thing in New Mexico, you would have been great to get released on the 28th, but on the 29th, you would have been in bad shape. So here's a guy that's got something of 3 months left in prison, and all of a sudden now, and he's actually contracted it, and no one's trying to let anybody go home early, which I think is also pretty shitty in the grand scheme of things, that you could take people that are 3 months, 6 months, a year out, you could start letting them go with people with more medical problems. Like, it seems that there would be ways to handle this if we were willing to, and we're just not willing to.
We're not willing to.
And I think that makes us kind of crappy. There's another article from The Appeal, Coronavirus in Jails and Prisons, and this one is about a nationwide report of all 50 states. The best state, I think, got a D minus.
And let me guess, the best state was Alabama or Mississippi, right?
Which one were the best ones? Massachusetts, Michigan, Tennessee, West Virginia, and Vermont were the best ones. They had tested everyone. But which one? Wyoming scored the second lowest, and Tennessee scored the highest, which I'm kind of surprised that Tennessee scored the highest.
So
there's that. Just again, as a reference point to that somebody, this was done by the ACLU. So, you know, hate on those people if you want to, that for trying to go out and figure out where people's civil liberties are being violated. Left-leaning crackpots, right, Larry?
That's what they are, a bunch of liberal do-gooders.
All right. And I think this is the Georgia case that you put in there as well. So this is from law.com again. An appeals court says state can prosecute charges dropped as part of federal plea deal. Larry, this always feels like flip-flop to me, where like, hey, we're not going to prosecute you, so you're free to go. Oh, wait, another group says we're going to prosecute you, so you're not free to go. This always confuses me.
That's not exactly what happened. The feds did prosecute him, and he made a plea agreement, which the drug charges were dropped. They decided that as part of the inducement to plea that they would drop, and the state of Georgia decided that they were going to file the charges. And the Georgia Court of Appeals has got this actually precisely correct, in my opinion. It's a very textual decision, but the Georgia statute, keep in mind that the feds and the state are two separate sovereigns, and there's no double jeopardy. The feds can prosecute you for the exact same facts that a state can prosecute you for. You can commit a crime, and if it's a federal crime, the feds can prosecute you for transporting that dope across the state lines to Alabama, and the state of Alabama can prosecute you for bringing that dope into Alabama, the same dope that the feds prosecuted you for. So what Georgia did is Georgia has a provision in their statutes where that if you are acquitted of the crime, then the feds can't pick it up. But that isn't what happened. He was not acquitted. The statute reads, well, of course, if you're convicted also, then but Georgia's official code of Georgia 16-1-8, a prosecution is barred if the accused was formally prosecuted for the same crime based upon the same material facts, if such form of prosecution resulted in either a conviction or an acquittal. Well, it didn't do either. He didn't get convicted, nor did he get acquitted. The charges were dismissed. So therefore,
and dismissed is not being found guilty or not guilty. We just said, hey, we're not playing ball anymore.
We're not moving this particular charge forward, which charges are always generally dismissed, almost always, in a plea bargain. Why would you plead to everything in the indictment? So the feds dismissed a charge that the state of Georgia decided that they were going to move forward with. So the Georgia Court of Appeals said, well, gee, we had issued a very inartfully crafted decision some years back, and we're clarifying that if it is for a dismissal because it's a plea bargain, that's not an acquittal. And you can't argue with them. A dismissal is not an acquittal. We get back to what does the meaning of the word is, or what is the meaning of the word all? Georgia law says it has to be a conviction or an acquittal. It wasn't either.
Okay.
So, and you textualists out there that listen to the podcast, you should be applauding every time we get a textual decision, because this is exactly what you're for. It's for a court to look at the text and to interpret the text. And the text is very clear. It doesn't give them any latitude for them to invent, well, they must have meant if also if it was dismissed. That isn't what it says. They're smart enough to put resulted in either conviction or acquittal, or the charges were subsequently dismissed. They didn't say that.
So I'm thinking back to maybe it was the early 90s, and there was the DC sniper. It was like, is the name John Lee Malvo? Is that the right name?
That was one of them, yes.
Okay, and so they committed the crimes in the entity of Maryland, and also in the entity that also happened, like in my, like almost in my neighborhood. That happened in the county that I grew up, like right up the street. But that's another story. But they committed those crimes in probably the D.C. and then also in Maryland and also in Virginia, and they were like prosecuting them in those specific districts. And I'm just saying that to give another point of reference to what you're describing the entities of the state and federal.
But those were still state courts. They were. I don't believe there were any federal charges in my recollection. We're talking about a case that was in federal court, Middle District of Georgia, and then we're talking about the Georgia picked up. Now, when you have crimes that state crimes that are, there's no federal jurisdiction, then. And they go across jurisdictional lines, the jurisdictions have to work on a plan of prosecution. Who's going to have first bite? Who's got the strongest case? What you want to do, if you put your ego aside, what you want to do in a case like that is you want to give the first bite at the state that has the strongest case that has a slam dunk. Because then you have the conviction and you have the person locked away, and then you can keep stacking time on there, or you can decide that the first state gave them enough time that you're just willing to induce a plea and give them concurrent time with what they're serving in the other state, and then you don't have to pay any money to incarcerate them, you don't have to pay any money to try them, but the prosecution, when there's multiple states involved, if you take the egos out, which they don't always do, they look at which state can secure a conviction, which state has the strongest case. Where can we win and make sure this person is locked away for a long period of time?
Are there any highlights in the Georgia one that you made? I'm looking at it. I don't see any.
I didn't really. I don't think I made any. Let's see. State versus Adams.
I don't see any.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if there's anything that you wanted to highlight and point out.
Yeah. And I think I pointed out it succinctly that it's really a textual decision. And I'm not always a textualist, but I can't fault their logic. They followed the law.
Very good. Let's see. What about Mississippi bill would give thousands chance at parole? This is Mississippi doing something that is like pro-criminal justice reform? How can that be?
Because it's Republicans doing it and they won't get vilified. That's how. Anything else?
All right, then we should just move on to the next article. Isn't this a case for when, in the last couple of weeks, we got slammed for being so lefty, like we're falling off the lefty bridge, and libtards, can I come up with the Democrat Party? Like, so here you're giving credit where credit is due for Sissabippi doing the right thing?
I didn't do a lot of analysis of it, but it looks like it will result in a significant drop in people that are incarcerated and the amount of times they'll be incarcerated. And I think that's a good thing. And I think that as I say over and over again, this is one area where you don't have to worry about the Democrat Party vilifying you. They will vilify you for other things you do as a conservative, but they will not vilify you for criminal justice reform. So you have carte blanche if you're a Republican to do as bold as you want to take on reform. And you don't have that carte blanche on other things. You can't, but on criminal justice reform, if you're going to make things better, make sure I clarify reform. If you're going to lessen the amount of time that people serve, because reform can also be making it more difficult and imposing more time. But if you want to make the criminal justice reforms that result in fewer people in prison and shorter sentences, the Democrat Party will not vilify you for that. So you have all the freedom you need.
In reading it, so if you're on the low end of the spectrum, that you could be eligible for parole after 25%, and on up the scale, then after 50%, and then I think after on the high end, you could be eligible at 75%. I think is where it's stacked up at. But that means you could get maybe something like 4 years for a minor kind of drug charge, and you could be eligible for parole after a year, which sounds good. But I think the key word there is eligible.
Well, that would be the key word if it's a discretionary act, because depending on who exercises the discretion, if that decision maker is within the purview of an elected official that has to be accountable for any bad decisions, of course they're going to exclude anybody with a sex offense and certain community sensitive offenses. They're going to exclude those, and we're just not even going to consider those. That's just the reality of it. It's not a rule that I make, but I'm telling you that's what the political reality is.
And it says in the end of one of the paragraphs, says, habitual offenders, PFRs, an inmate sentenced for capital murder would not be eligible for parole. So what, yay for
what,
that.
What a surprise.
I know, right? I know. I guess we can move over to the New York Times. What do you call that one, Larry?
The New York Times. I think I've heard Rush call it the New York Slimes.
Got it. The black officer who detained George Floyd had pledged to fix the police. This is a kind of an interesting little profile of Alex King, is how it's pronounced. It looks like it's Kyung, but it's pronounced King. He had been on his third shift, and he's kind of been like denounced from his community. He tried to join the force of trying to get in there to change it from the inside. And there he is standing there. He had the opportunity to perhaps pull back the officer that had his knee in George Floyd's back. I do have to say, I'll cut the guy some level of slack that it was his third shift. I would imagine that you're probably still like trying to figure out what the ropes are. Forget learning the ropes, but like you don't even know where the ropes are. And I got to cut the guy the teeniest little bit of slack in that regard. However, when someone is saying, I can't breathe, and it's 8 minutes, like, humanity should probably kick in and act. Anyway, so here's that article.
That was what I took from the thing. I didn't read the entire thing, but you know, you got a rookie officer and a veteran with how many years did he have with the force? It's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, you would be scared to death to make a move that then you end up getting your ass beat or, you know, getting reprimanded, fired, whatever. But in the end, he could have saved a life. That's a whole conflict of problems to try and figure out at the time. It's the only level of slack that I'll give the guy in that regard.
So
another one from the New York Times. This one is a nice little video also that I have already played, so I don't remember. What is this one? I'm trying to remember. What is this one, Larry? Help me out.
The tear gas.
Oh, this is the Philadelphia tear gas one. This one's awesome. Protesters start marching down the highway, and the police blocked. They boxed them in. They came in from the front. They came in from the back. What appeared to be kind of peaceful. I will say I will cut the police some slack that they were blocking the interstate at this time, too. But they started shooting tear gas. Larry, did you watch the whole video?
Oh, yeah. It was funny.
Oh, my God. Yeah, funny in certain terms. They will like go up to you and be inches from you, pull down your mask and squirt tear gas directly in your face. There was one other guy who ended up with like a tear gas canister or something that shot him and hit him in the cheek. And he's got like a stamp, like an embroidery stamp, like right on his cheek. And towards the end of it, where like the protesters, they had been boxed in and they only had one way to go out. They go up this hill and there's this like 8-foot fence they've got to scale. So then they start going back down, right down the hill back into where the cops are with the tear gas and all that stuff.
You have to admit that if you don't pull the mask off, the tear gas is not going to be nearly as effective.
It would not be nearly as effective. It did seem a little odd that there were guidelines that they shouldn't be using tear gas against peaceful protesters. And there was a clip of the police captain, whatever you want to call her. And she was like, well, once they got onto the highway, well, now they were violent protesters. That's your definition of violent protester?
Yep. So, well, you know, Andy, you people always second guess. We're in a pressure cook situation, trying to keep all the citizenry safe. And all you people do is sit back in your ivory towers. You've never been out in the trenches, and all you do is criticize and second guess. I mean, these men and women are working, sacrificing, putting their life on the line every day, and all we get is just continuous criticism. Well, what is it? What is it with you people?
I struggle with the posture, I suppose, that they, you know, they're in all the black, they're in the tactical gear, they're in gas masks. So like, you can't see the people. These are the people that are charged with our safety and our security. And now they're looking, frankly, like a terrorist organization to me. And they have all the weaponry and they have the tactical control and radios and equipment. And these are just people that are walking down the street. Yes, some of them were doing some vandalism, so you could figure out who those are. And like, I don't know. This seems to be extreme, excessive, over the top. Send me hate mail for being a libtard, blah, blah, blah. I think this is excessive. And we should hold them accountable to it.
Well, thank goodness people like you are not making the rules.
Yes, because if I were making the rules, it would be worse, way worse, which is possibly true. I don't think I'm qualified for this stuff, but I think this is really just crappy over-the-top stuff.
So, well, thankfully, we've got more sane, rational decision makers out there trying to keep us safe. We'd be anarchy with your kind.
Yes. And then over at the Daily News, what can we learn from Rashad Brooks? Reform of parole and probation is just as important as police. This is the Georgia one and Wendy's situation that happened a month ago when you were here?
Yeah, I put that in there because people lose sight of probation, parole, how that was supposed to be a system to aid the offender, to educate and mentor the offender, rather than the way it has evolved to being something, I got you, and how can we put so many hoops up that you'll fail? Probation and parole is supposed to be rehabilitative, particularly probation, but even parole, theoretically, you've done enough time that you deserve a chance to be reintegrated into the community. And the parole officer, probation officer, is supposed to be pulling for you.
Right. Not setting up trip traps for you while you're on your way. I heard a little segment on his record and how when you read it as what the charges were or what he was convicted of versus what the scenario was, it paints an entirely different picture. You know, if I see you and I'm driving down the street, Larry, and I come and I screech up and I pull up and I'm like, get in the car. And you're like, no. And now I like reach out and grab your hand. Now I have attempted kidnapping. And it's like, so he was in some sort of argument with his wife, girlfriend, I forget which one it is. And he like grabbed her arm and moved her, which is now like unlawful detaining. What's the, you know, like imprisonment. I forgot what the right word is. So, you know, I'm not saying he's clean, but he's also not like a terrorist either. And this all gets painted in the media at times as him being this terrible, hardened felon. And maybe he deserved what he got kind of thing, but it doesn't, I don't think that the scenario that he was actually in paints that really that extreme of a picture.
Well, the media tends to do that with anybody who has any type of record, and they have police instigation helping them. When the cops provide the rap sheet, they provide a commentary with it also. And okay. since most people don't understand the title statutes inevitably have evil sounding.
Yes.
Criminal sexual penetration. That sounds pretty heinous, doesn't it? It may be only criminal because the person was not of age to give the consent that they gave. So you committed a criminal sexual penetration. Mm-hmm. Strong armed robbery. So if you go on with, and the cops will provide their commentary, and these reporters are reporting on 1,000 things in the course of a year. Do you expect they actually will do all the research to figure out what the statute means, what the elements are, and how to be objective when that's not what the viewers or listeners or readers are wanting?
And at the same time that you're saying that they are competing against the other three or four broadcasters to have the most up-to-date compassion, you know, compelling, interesting, bleeding, leading, all that stuff. So they don't necessarily even have the time to, nor are they incentivized to be super duper fact checkers. They're just, even if they make a mistake, they're not going to go back and retract it and correct it. It's
very
gone.
Very infrequently, but they're in the business of making money. We lose sight of that.
We
bemoan this in our capitalist system. They are not in the business of doing anything other than making a profit.
Right.
Except for the PBS, which we decry. And I think the total support for PBS in this country is like less than a dollar per person, per American per year.
My understanding is it's something of 1 or 2%, and it happens either before or after election cycles, so that they're not politically motivated at all, is my understanding.
But we're harsh on the media, but they do what they do in a capitalist system. They're trying to drive ratings. They're trying to sell magazines. They're trying to sell papers and fast and being first. All those things are important. If you don't like that, then perhaps we ought to look at some of the things that would give us an alternative to that. And those things will cost money. And when you start talking about, well, I mean, when you say, well, do you want to restrict what they can? Well, no, we can't do that. That violates the First Amendment. Clearly it would. Well, do you want to put more money in public broadband? Oh, no, we can't do that. That damn liberal do good right. stuff. We can't do that. Well, do you want to bring the fairness doctrine? No, we can't do that. Do you want to decentralize ownership? Do you want to make the? I mean, we have these big media conglomerates. Do you want to break them up so that we have more local ownership? No, we can't do that. There's nothing. No matter what option you put on the table, you can't have a rational discussion about it. So the media is going to be what the media is, and unfortunately, they vilify everybody and they make this guy sound like he was the most awful criminal that ever was, because that's the cops' playbook. When someone dies at the hands of the cops, this is a nationwide thing they do. They take every little incident in their life and they make it sound like that person was a horrible human being. That justifies what they did.
I understand. Moving over to an article from NPR, how authorities can use the internet to identify protesters. What is your take on things like this, Larry, before we get into the details?
Well, I struggle with it because there's no expectation of privacy when you're out in public. On the other hand, there is an expectation that our government doesn't track us and catalog and chronicle our movements. So I have a lot of struggling with this.
It's really easy for the police, for the government in general, to gain access to huge amounts of processing power, to gain cell phone data, to gain Google records, and paint a very accurate, very detailed, not necessarily accurate, detailed picture of your whereabouts and your associates. You probably pretty easily remember the metadata conversation that was happening probably around 2010 or so. Like, it was really big in the news about not knowing what your conversation was about, but by knowing who you called and how long you called them, you could probably discern a lot about an individual based just on that level of detail. Couple that in with other things and some more artificial intelligence analysis, and you end up with the government having a very close watch on what you're up to.
That's the scary part about it. Because, like I say, there's no expectation of privacy, but there's also there's no expectation that the government's going to catalog and chronicle your movements.
Do you know about the huge data warehouse facility in Utah? This was an article I read so long ago. It's a 10-year-old article that I read about this data storage facility in Utah.
Doesn't ring any bells.
I'm going to assume that the information is right. I know that I read the article in Wired magazine. And it is a facility that will capture, for lack of a better term, all internet traffic would get stored. That means every Skype phone call you've made, every internet search you've done, all of that data is stored at some warehouse facility in Utah that when they do get the processing power to go scrape it, they will employ that. And maybe they have it by now. That you have no sense of privacy in it. They want to go do a dragnet and figure out what you've been up to for the last 6, 10, you know, number of years. They can just go pull the archive and figure out what you've been up to.
Tragic is not the word, but yeah, it is discombobulating that they can do that. But that's the world we live in with technology, and you tech gurus are all for this.
Some of us, but at the same time, there are other tools that you can employ to mask a lot of that. You use some encryption app with your boss. I use encryption apps. Most people are like, psh, I don't care about that. No one's reading my stuff. I'm just sending puppy pictures across the internet. Like, yeah, but there's probably stuff that you don't want everyone to know about, or that they don't have any right to know about either. Even though you're in the public, they shouldn't be cataloging and tracking and watching all the whereabouts that you go to. So, I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting thing that you threw here in here this week. I think you always like to poke fun at me for internet like technology stuff.
Well, because I do that because I like to have the discussion about the downsides and how we structure our society, where that there's no incentive for these voluntary controls. So we're going to have to use the powers of the big old bad government to place limitations on how this technology is used. And that means that we have to have an engaging debate. We can't just let the companies decide that they own everything that they capture from people and that they can't be allowed to do with it what they please.
So you probably, I think we covered it, or at least, you know, just in passing, that Amazon said that they would stop selling their facial recognition technology to law enforcement. They would do a moratorium for a year and are willing to step up and help government write policy, whatever, draft the laws. And that probably is so that they can figure out how to secure their position and have a profitable endeavor and possibly block different players from getting into it.
No.
And but that reminded me directly of things that you have brought forth that, hey, I will help you guys write it. And you described something where you wrote it that basically no one would ever be charged for this kind of crime. And I guess to cover that in a different way, you know, these different removal from the registry processes, no one would ever qualify because they're like so narrowly tailored that you'd have to pat your head and full moon on this time when the whole thing occurred, blah, blah, blah. You'd never get off the registry.
Well, I do it to try to make it constitutional, because if they're determined to have a law, and in many instances they are determined to have a law, I trust me to write it better than I trust law enforcement. And once I accept that a law is inevitable, and I would have accepted an example in Michigan, they're not going to just let those people disappear. And so I would have been busily writing a registry that I believe would be constitutional. I know it goes against everything we talk about, but would you rather they write it or me write it?
Them, for sure, Larry.
So I look at it, if I know something's inevitable, I would prefer that I draft it, because I'm going to make sure I guard the constitutional, and I'm going to make a registry that's constitutional. My registry would be so benign that most people wouldn't like it, but I'd say, look, this is constitutional. They can gripe all they want to, but you can do this. But you can't go beyond this, because you're going to find yourself right back in a constitutional confrontation, because you can't do all the things you'd like to do. You can't punish people, but you can have people on lists. We have hundreds of lists that people are on, and being on a list doesn't make that list unconstitutional.
It doesn't even make it that bad to be on the list. It depends on where that list is then presented.
Well, I don't worry so much about the list. I worry about what the list discloses and what you're required to do while you're a member of the list. You're on the list for the Selective Service when you're from 18 to 26. They don't do anything with the list. They don't in any way humiliate right. you. They don't do anything that impairs your ability to live your life. A registry of sexual offenders would be, you could do such a list. You don't require them to report in. You don't require them to have any prohibitions about where they can live, where they can work, what they can do, who they can engage with. And you simply say, congratulations, you're on a list. Like you tell the young men between 18 and 26, congratulations, you're on a list. If you don't put your name on this list, you're subject to forfeiture of a whole plethora of government benefits in addition to a 5-year period of incarceration. I doubt anybody's ever been incarcerated for 5 years, but it is on the books. It could be imposed.
I'm with you. So then we move over to courthouse news. Judge grants bond for ex-Atlanta cop charged in Rashard Brooks' killing. Come on, Larry. You can't be in favor of taking this guy who, like, gunned this dude down, like, almost in cold blood. He shot him in the back. You can't be in favor of this.
Actually, I am.
because
we have this presumption of innocence, and a person is entitled to that presumption, and it follows them to the conclusion of the proceedings. That doesn't revert to a presumption of guilt. Again, as I said dozens of times, I only wish the police would say the same thing when someone's arrested. This officer is entitled to be presumed innocent through the duration of this proceeding until he elects to plead guilty or until he's convicted by a jury. And while he's proceeding to trial, he is entitled to be free as long as the restraints are sufficient to secure his participation. I think the bond was $750,000, wasn't it?
It was either $500,000 at the top.
$500,000. Okay, well, that's probably enough to encourage an average person to participate if you can raise $500,000.
Yeah, I didn't want to split the difference between that $250,000. Like I'm thinking $750,000 would be hard to come up with. $500,000 would be just slightly as hard.
So yes, he's entitled to bond, and he can put together the best defense that he can afford, and he may even qualify, since he's been fired. He may even qualify for indigent defense. Who knows? But I don't feel any differently about him than I do any other accused person. I'm just waiting for when we can invite a police officer on this podcast that will say the same thing about someone other than a police officer. Please, if you're listening, come on. We'll be nice to you, and we want you to say what I just said.
innocent until proven guilty, right?
And that the person's entitled to that presumption to follow them through the duration of the proceeding.
All right, then we'll go over to Clarion Ledger. Ready for him to come home? Family says MS prison reform bill should be retroactive. That would be Mississippi, I assume.
Yes.
And advocates for reform in the Mississippi prison system sit down with the Clarion Ledger to discuss their concerns after a wave of violence and deaths. Was there a video out there that we had about a riot breaking out in Mississippi?
There's a video with this article, but I got confused with this article. I thought we had already covered it.
I don't recall covering this.
Okay, well.
I guess this goes with the Mississippi, the parole bill?
Yeah.
Should I have blocked these together? They're just the same thing, just two different sources?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Well, then I guess we could just move on to the final.
They want it to be retroactive. How dare them want something to be retroactive? But you can make things lesser punitive. The Constitution protects you against making it more punitive, but you can reduce sentences retroactively. There's no constitutional infringement there.
Okay. Yeah. No, I understand. So I think, isn't that everything?
That's everything. We just have Will here with his.
We have a question. This was a comment that he left last week in reference to RM-133. It says, with regard to the expectation of privacy, there was a case in 2015 where a PFR was arrested for taking pictures of children playing in a public space. The judge ruled that the children were out in a public area where there was no expectation of privacy, and therefore the registered citizen committed no crime by taking non-obscene pictures. This is on the heels of the protests and the government tracking and all the stuff that you have no expectation of privacy. But I wanted to bring that to the fore.
I'd like to see that ruling, and I agree with it, and I've said the same thing many times. These laws, you can pass anything, and they're presumed constitutional. You can say a PFR is not allowed to take pictures of anyone in a park. But I maintain they're allowed to take pictures anywhere that anybody's allowed to take pictures. If there's no prohibition of general population, a PFR can take pictures like anyone else. But if you pass a law that says they can't, well, they can't until the court says they can. And this person decided that they wanted to challenge it. And apparently, at least at a trial court level, there's been a decision that says that they can take pictures. Now, the state will have an answer for this. They'll say, well, if you can take pictures at a park, we'll just make it where you can't be in a park. And then you won't be able to take any pictures. That would be their logical move that they would make.
On the heels of that, they could say you can't have any sort of camera technology, which is hard, but you could. You could find a camera on a. You could find a phone that doesn't have a camera on it. It'd be hard, but you probably could.
I think the last one was made actually about 10 years ago.
Probably. Any closing comments before we shut it all down, Larry?
What's this about Restore Georgia?
I think that's left over from. Yeah, that's.
Totally oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That's last week. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we're ready to close down shop and everybody have a wonderful Independence Day. I know that only a few people will hear it that are hearing it now. So those of you that are hearing it on the early release, I hope you had a wonderful Independence Day and weekend and ready to get back to the grindstone next week.
Outstanding. It was a short week. So that was a nice little treat. And thank you all very much. You can find show notes over at registrymatters.co and all the other things you can find over there if you want to contact us. With that, Larry, thank you so much for joining me yet again. Mike, thank you for being a guest for a little while. And take care, everybody. Good night.
Good night.